I can remember my grandmother saying to me, "You can do anything you want if you just set your mind to it." At the time she said it, I must say that the reality of the simple adage went past me. But over the years, I've come to realize how true it was. Each of us has the power within to attract whatever we want. Indeed, be careful what you wish for, because you're going to get it. The possibilities are limitless. And I am recalling the words of Rumi, the 13th century Persian Sufi poet. "Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down the dulcimer. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground." Our guest, Wayne Dyer, has spent more than 2 decades writing and speaking about the ways to manifest your vision in the world and pursue your authentic path. Wayne Dyer is acknowledged worldwide as the father of motivation and is described by another well-known author and speaker, Marianne Williamson, as one of America's foremost teachers of transformational wisdom. He lectures throughout the world and has written numerous best-selling books, including Pulling Your Own Strings, the best-selling book of the 1970s, Real Magic, Manifest Your Destiny, and Wisdom of the Ages, A Modern Master Brings Eternal Truths into Everyday Life. Join us for the next hour as we explore the fascinating territory of creating your life the way you want it with Wayne Dyer. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Wayne, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be with you again, Michael.
Same here. Wayne, you know, there's an interesting story about how you wrote Wisdom of the Ages, and I want to ask you, you know, how did that book come to be?
Well, I had there were two parts to it, really. I had I was a teacher for most of my life, school teacher, a college professor, various levels of education, and I always was very deeply touched by the wisdom of ancient masters. I've always used a lot of quotations, and I felt very connected to many of the people that are in this book. And my students used to always say to me, "What is what somebody said 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago? What's that got to do with me? This is now. This is today. That was ancient times." And I guess writing this book was my answer to that question. Orrin Lyons, the great Native American philosopher and poet, said that when we walk upon Mother Earth, we always plant our feet very carefully, because we know the faces of our future generations are looking up at us from beneath the ground, and we never forget them. And I think that we were looking up at our ancestors.
Yes.
And whether those ancestors were Rumi, as you just discussed, or whether it was Pythagoras, or whether it was Shelley or Keats or Yeats or Martin Luther King Jr. or whomever, that all of these people had a very strong sense of passion. And it wasn't so much what they had to say as how they lived their lives that really intrigued me. And the second part of how this book came about is that I really wanted to look at the qualities of higher consciousness or self-actualization. Maslow was a very profound teacher in my life. In fact, he died the very same day, on the 14th of June, 1970, that I received my doctorate.
Wow.
And I often felt that a baton was passed on, that he had sort of said, "This is what it is, now you explain it to all the cab drivers and the pizza delivery boys."
Right.
Because that's kind of what I did when I was growing up.
Yes.
And so I took the qualities of higher consciousness or self-actualization that Maslow spoke about, and I took 60 of the most profound teachers, and I put them together and decided to write an essay a day for 60 days. I call this 60 Days to Enlightenment. Read an essay a day for 60 days on 60 of the greatest teachers, and watch what happens in your life.
So can we expect a continuing series of Wisdom of the Ages?
I was just asked that. Someone's asked me, you know, it's like chicken soup. You know?
Right.
I don't know about Wisdom of the Ages for the golfer. I'm not sure.
Well, it's a good practice, just generally, I think, to go back to what I would call perennial wisdom, because these insights, these teachings, I mean, they are profound and they're timeless.
Absolutely. And these people, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the sense, Michael, of walking in places where our ancestors walked. Particularly, I was in Greece. Deepak Chopra and I we took a group of people to Greece a couple of years ago, and we were walking through the Parthenon.
Yes.
He was saying to me, in the way he always says things,
yes.
You know, do you realize that you are drinking the same water that Socrates drank, and
yes.
You're breathing the same air that Pythagoras breathed, and you're looking up at the same sun that you know that Plato looked up at, and you have a sense of our connection, because when you realize that we are not these bodies, we are not this world of form. That there's a sacred hoop, if you will, that connects everything that ever was and ever is, and ever will be. That in a true sense, we are literally, spiritually connected to all of these people who walked before us. And most of them, the intriguing thing about these people is that none of them died with their music still in them. You know, they had a strong sense of passion about their lives. And,
yes.
And they weren't going to get to the end of their life and say, what if my whole life has been wrong, like Ivan Illich? And they were also troublemakers. You know, almost so many of them. Many of them were.
Did Ivan Illich say that?
Pardon?
Did Ivan Illich say
yes,
that?
Yes, right.
Yeah. Really?
What if my whole life has been wrong? You know, imagine lying on your deathbed, you know, contemplating that thought and the
yeah,
death
really.
Of Ivan Illich. Yeah. And, and that, as I said, they were troublemakers. I mean, these were people who. You know, society sort of honors our living conformists and our dead troublemakers. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but many of these people were placed in prison. Some were crucified. Many of them were thought to be insane. And yet they didn't seem to care about that. They were independent of all of that.
You know, when I heard when you said Ivan Illich, you know, I thought you were talking about Tolstoy's Ivan Illich. I was thinking of Ivan Illich.
Oh, no, no.
And
no,
the contemporary
yeah,
Ivan Illich. Right. I thought, oh, gee, did he say his life, you know.
No, Tolstoy's the death of Ivan Illich.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah,
right. I wanted to make that distinction because I kind of got carried away there with the other contemporary Illich.
Well, I'm in a historical mode here. So.
Well, you know, I just want to, I think it's a great point you make. And I can remember as a child, I grew up in Virginia being struck by the, I had an early interest in the Civil War, and of course Virginia is, you know, a place to have that interest.
Yes.
And I used to get my parents to stop at every battlefield, you know. And as a kid, I felt that the energy of the battlefield, you know, it was like an energy hit, and it was like I was in touch with that. And as a child, and you know, as I've grown older in history, I've always gone to historical places. And it's like there's a morphic, you know, saying like in Sheldrake's terms, it's a morphic field of energy.
Absolutely.
Present. So when you go walk along the through the Parthenon, there's a morphic field of energy there.
There's no question about that. I just had an experience. Let me share it with you.
Yes.
Because I know how the show works. We can do it stream of consciousness.
Yes.
I was in South Africa 12 days ago, and I spoke in Cape Town and I spoke in Johannesburg. And we took a ferry over to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for 17 of his 27 years. And this now is a sort of like a national park kind of thing, and the former inmates are now the people who guide the people through it, and you pay, and this is how they make a living. And, of course, all of the people that were in Robben Island were there for two reasons. One, because they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. They were mostly picked up at meetings of the ANC someplace in the you know, people who were protesting apartheid. And two, they were there because they were black. It was because they segregated the population. So basically, Robben Island was a place where people were incarcerated because they were innocent, right? And there was an awful lot of suffering that went on there amongst innocent people who just were protesting the system called apartheid.
Yes.
And I sat and I stood there in the cell where Nelson Mandela was, and I went in there with a little boy who lives in South Africa. He's 11 years old, and the people who had brought me over there, nobody else wanted to go over there. My wife didn't want to go. No one thought that that was a place to go. But for me, being there in that place,
yes,
was a moving experience, because I feel, Michael, that that the reason that, that whole transformation took place in South Africa with relatively little violence was because Mandela was was forced, if you will, into silence for a long, long period of time. And when you're forced into silence, you begin to commune with God. That's what meditation is really about. And he came out with forgiveness and reconciliation in his heart, and it literally radiated to the whole country, and I think to the whole planet. Anyway, when we came out of that, we got off the ferry, we came back, and when we walked out of the cell, that little boy, Simeon, looked at me and he said, I didn't, I felt wrong in there. In his little 11-year-old voice, that's all he could say. I felt wrong in there. I felt so strongly that I was doing everything I could to stop myself from breaking out into tears. And it wasn't because of my thoughts so much as the energy. I don't know, have you ever been to the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam?
I never have, no.
I take my daughter, whenever I go to Amsterdam to speak, I always take one of my daughters there, and we walk through there. The last time I walked through there, I couldn't catch my breath. It was so thick with sadness and heaviness.
Yes.
And I had the opposite exact feeling when I went into the Pontuncula in Florence, or in Assisi, rather, where St. Francis had done all of his healing and all of his prayer. It was the most wonderful feeling of bliss. I was just recently in Machu Picchu in Peru. Have you ever been up there?
I have not been to Machu Picchu, no.
5 days of absolute feeling of well-being like I've never known before. There's like what you're saying is there's an energy.
Yes.
And this energy is left over, if you will. And if there's been negative, I remember Stuart Wilde telling me that he stayed in a hotel in Copenhagen one night, and he kept seeing demons in the middle of the night. He couldn't sleep. And the next day he found out that this was the Nazi headquarters that particular hotel. And he's very sensitive to that kind of energy.
Yes.
So it's like, we're connected. There's more than just a thought connection between ourselves and all of these masters and all of these things.
It's the invisible world.
Mm.
Invisible
but that thing world. With Nelson Mandela was really, really deeply touching.
It sounds that it was a very powerful experience. I can hear it in your voice,
right,
for sure. You know, I want to acknowledge you, Wayne, as someone who, you know, I think I first... we first had one of these dialogues maybe in 1981, something like that.
Right.
And it was that when we were on State Street in San Francisco.
Right. I remember.
And, you know, you're someone who, when I first met you, you know, I remember you came in a pair of running shorts and you had a Diet Coke in your hand, you know, and a sweatshirt kind of thing. And you were kind of still kind of jogging, as it were.
Right.
As you came into the office, you know. And anyway, so that was a kind of an interesting vision.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't quite match my expectations, that whatever they were at the time. And just over the years, you know, just I want to say that I've appreciated the fact that you have remained consistent to the words that you have expressed publicly in lots of places and the words that you've written in your book. I mean, you're someone who I say has walked their talk. And I just want to acknowledge you publicly here on the air as someone who's done that, and that's not easy to do, particularly when you're expressing positive ideas and you're saying, hey, there's something else here, there is a way out, that, you know, we've got problems, yes, and there's other ways to look at the world and other ways to address this. And often in our society, people like yourself are seen as Pollyannish or, you know, criticized because you're not being, quote, realistic,
right,
or you're not really
yeah.
seeing the real picture.
Well,
and so I just want to acknowledge you.
Well, thank you.
For hanging in there for 20-some years.
I heard Marianne Williamson one time when she was interviewed, I don't know if it was on New Dimensions or whatever, when someone said they accused her of being Pollyannish. She said, well, that was one of the greatest compliments that she ever had. She said, here was this young girl who came to this town where everybody was gloomy and depressed and down, and after she'd been there for a week, everybody was happy and thrilled, and the
right.
economy was thriving and everything was going well. Being a Pollyanna is probably not such a bad thing to be called, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
But this is something, when you say that, Michael, you say it's not easy. I've never thought of this as very difficult, and I've never thought of it as risk-taking. I've just always spoken from my heart about what I believe in, and there have been enormous shifts and growths for me throughout these 25 or 30 years that I've
yes.
been before the microphones of America.
Yes.
I now speak about spirituality, but I still live exactly what I speak from my heart, I write from my heart, and that's
yes.
what we do.
Yes. Well, that's a good way to go.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Wayne Dyer, author of Wisdom of the Ages, A Modern Master Brings Eternal Truths into Everyday Life, and Manifest Your Destiny, The 9 Spiritual Principles for Getting Everything You Want. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Thank you. My guest is Wayne Dyer, author of Wisdom of the Ages and many other books that have been bestsellers. And Wayne travels the world speaking, expressing himself from his heart, as he said earlier. And we're talking about how we can find wisdom in the midst of everyday life, because it's there. We just have to see clearly and become more aware. I want to go to some of the parts of Wisdom of the Ages, and there's a particular piece on hope where you have a quote from Michelangelo, and the greatest danger for most of us is not that our aim is too high and we miss it, but that it is too low and we reach it. And let's talk about hope.
Okay. I have been accused over the years in the critical press of providing false hope to people. People will call, and I'll be on a talk show on the radio someplace in the world, and someone will call in who's been diagnosed with a terminal illness of some kind, and I will talk to them about not buying into the diagnosis, about, you know, why would you just listen to a group of people who have a vested interest in convincing you of this impending doom in your life, and the law that has ever allowed any miracle to ever take place in the history of humanity is still on the books. It hasn't been repealed, so that energy, whatever it is, whoever has ever healed themselves of a diagnosis of terminal illness, used the same kind of energy that is in you. And so people say, well, that's providing false hope and so on. And I remember, again, to speak about Michelangelo, I mean, these people that I selected for, or that selected me for Wisdom of the Ages, I feel after studying their lives in depth and looking at not only what they had to say but what they were like, I mean, I feel like you're talking about my grandfather or something when you speak about Michelangelo. And again, in Florence, when we went to Florence, I said, I'm just going to go see the statue of David. And I thought, well, I'll just look at this statue. You know, everybody has to see David.
Yes.
And I walked in there, and you go through this long corridor, and you see all of these slaves on either side that are coming out of the concrete that were all sculpted by Michelangelo. And then you come into this room that's all lit, and then there's this statue, this magnificent statue, and it's 18 feet high. And it is the most astounding thing I've ever seen. And I'm not a big art critic or even going to art shows and sculpture and all that. I enjoy it, but it's not something that I have a passion about.
Yes.
Well, 4 hours later, Michael, I was still standing in front of that statue. My wife and my three daughters were out climbing El Duomo and buying shoes and doing all the things that you do when you're in Italy.
Right.
And they came back and they said, Dad, come on, we have to leave. And I felt like I couldn't leave that place. It was such a beautiful experience. I mean, the you can see every vein in the in this thing, and it's just a magnificent experience. So when they ask, you know, there's this wonderful quote that they ask Michelangelo, how could you have created such a perfect specimen of sculpture from one piece of marble? His famous quote is that David was already in the marble. I just chipped away the excess.
Yes.
You know, and that there's a David inside each and every one of us.
Yes.
And this idea of if you're, you know, the greater danger is not that our hopes are too high and we fail to reach them, it's that they are too low and we do. And most people see themselves in terms, they don't see, I think you should see yourself as a saint, you know, and I think a person ought to be envisioning themselves as capable of doing anything. I think it's possible to excel in every area of life. That is, you don't have to sort of restrict yourself to one area. I think you can enjoy going to a National Football League game in the afternoon and going to the ballet in the evening.
Yes.
And people say, well, you're a speaker. Usually speakers, and you get paid a lot for speaking, so you usually speakers are not good writers, you know, or because one is introverted and so supposedly and one is extroverted. And I have often thought, why can't you be a really fine writer and a great speaker as well?
Sure.
And why can't you be a great athlete and a poet as well? Why not? And most of these people, like Goethe and Michelangelo and Da Vinci and Shakespeare and Pope and so many of these people, these were people who were masters at a thousand different things.
Well, I know you've been to Bali, and I've been to Bali, and one of the things about Bali that was very impressive to me is the fact that in Bali you'll often run into people who they might be a waiter in the restaurant or in the hotel or whatever, and they're also a sculptor, a carver, a wood carver.
Right.
They may be a dancer at night. Mm. The Balinese have multiple creative talents, and they use all of them.
Isn't that interesting? How we, like in medicine now, I mean, now you have a specialist who specializes in the right finger. You know?
Right, exactly.
We have hand specialists, and we have foot specialists, and nose
exactly.
specialists. And imagine going to school for years and studying only the hand.
Yes.
You know, whereas here was Da Vinci or Michelangelo, and they studied, you know, they were anatomists. I mean, they studied anatomy and were medical people. You know, they the way that Michelangelo learned about, you know, how to do sculpture was by examining cadavers. They would literally steal the cadavers and go through, and he would examine them. And you know, it's like when you discover the greatness that's in yourself, you know, and not restricting yourself in any way. You know, think big, I guess, is the answer to that. Think big.
In Wisdom of the Ages, in the Michelangelo part, you mentioned the Sistine Chapel, and it just reminds me of the great story I like to remember about Michelangelo, was that sculpting was his primary passion, and he did painted the Sistine Chapel ceiling to subsidize his passion of sculpting.
Right.
So the Sistine Chapel to Michelangelo was a throwaway.
Right, it was an afterthought. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, this is my evening job.
Yeah, exactly. Right. This is my part-time job while I do pursue my sculpting.
Yeah.
I'm in
my 80s. I'm going to go lie down on my back for
right.
4 years and
right.
do this in my spare time so that
exactly.
I can do what I really love to do.
Really.
And not enough of us can think of ourselves as being able to excel in all areas and to have high hopes about virtually everything. Because High Hopes is not just a song that Frank Sinatra sang with a bunch of kids. High Hopes is being able to visualize and see for yourself what it is that you'd like to be able to accomplish in your life. I don't know if I've told this story here on New Dimensions. If I have, stop me. But it was, we'll tell it again anyway.
Tell it again anyway.
Right. I was in Maui about 4 or 5 years ago, and a woman named Jan saw me at the walk into the restaurant, and I had been on AM Los Angeles the day before.
Yes.
And so she had recognized me, and I had flown in, and she said, "Come on over." And she was sitting there with her husband. Okay. Now her husband's name was Wayne. Also, his name was Wayne Gretzky. Now,
yes.
I assume you know who.
Yeah,
Wayne
the
Gretzky
hockey
is.
Player,
right.
The famous hockey player.
Right. Probably the most famous hockey player
yes.
that has ever laced on a pair of skates. And this is not about hockey. It is more about how does someone get to be the greatest in what they accomplish in the world, all right? I mean, this guy, when I grew up, I wanted to be a hockey player. And Gordie Howe and people like that from back in the,
right.
from the Detroit Red Wings. And
back in the Pleistocene era, right?
Right. Well, and they'd set records that never were going to be broken. In a few years, this skinny little kid from Ontario comes out and breaks every hockey record that has ever been set, all right?
Yes.
And so I meet him, and he doesn't have a clue of who I am, all right? But his wife has read my books and so on. So we're talking, and whenever I meet somebody who's achieved at the very highest level, whatever it is, whether they play hockey or whether they write books or whatever it is, I'm interested in how they got to be there.
Yes.
This guy's maybe 5'10". He weighs maybe 160 pounds. He's a skinny little guy. He doesn't look, and I say to him, how did you get to be able to break every record that's ever been set in hockey? And he said, "I go to practice." I said, who doesn't go to practice? It was
yes.
a professional hockey player. And after we talked, it must have taken me an hour to get this out of him. And finally he said this to me. He said, "When I'm on the ice and I shoot I shoot the puck and I score a goal," he said, "I can see the puck going in the net just before I shoot it." And I thought, that's, you know, there's a real important lesson in there for every one of us. You know, you see a golfer standing out on a tee on a green, and they wait. Jack Nicklaus was asked, "Why do you stand there so long? Are you waiting for the grass to grow?" What?
Yes.
And he said, I don't hit the ball until I can see it going in the hole in my mind." And I think that the ability to be able to go inside, close your eyes, if you will, get a vision of what it is that you would like to accomplish, and then follow through on that vision, that's probably what separates out the highest functioning people at the very highest levels from the rest of us who have our vision after we've accomplished it rather than before.
Yes. Well, I know I've heard similar stories, not the same, but like I think Cal Ripken also had a story about practice, that the reason he got to play in so many games and is as good as he is is practice.
Right.
Just constantly practice. And also, I would imagine Michael Jordan might say something about visualizing.
Well, you know, it there's a, I call it the four pathways to mastery. And because most of these people in Wisdom of the Ages practice these four pathways. The first pathway is called discipline. All right. So this is like you have to train the body. Right? So you have to go to practice.
Yes. Right?
The second, now we're not talking about education here. We're talking about mastery. The second pathway is called wisdom. And that is the application of the mind to what you've trained yourself to do. So if you're going out to learn how to hit a, you know, shoot a basket or to hit a tennis ball or to make a lemon meringue pie or dance the Macarena or anything, the first thing you do is you train your body, you get it in shape, and the second thing you do is you apply wisdom, the mind, to it. Right? Now, this is what we mean by education. So that if we send our children off to school, we say to them, you know, get some discipline and use your head. And basically, you've got an education.
Yes.
But that's not mastery. The top two levels of mastery include the third one's called unconditional love. I watched Pavarotti sing at one of the three tenors, you know,
Sylvia Winter's
sure. concert, the,
yes.
the 42,000 of us at a football stadium in
wow.
Florida.
Yeah.
And they had a screen on him, Michael, that was 30 feet high. That's three stories high, and they right. showed a close-up of him. Now, this is a man, how many times has he sang O Sole Mio
yes.
in Italian, all
right?
There's nobody in the stadium understands Italian, but it doesn't matter. They show a close-up on his face on this 30-foot screen, and he is in bliss. He's
yes.
just in bliss. And I said to my wife, who was sitting next to me, I said, honey, I said, this guy has obviously gone to practice. I mean, you've
right.
got to practice to be the best in the world. And he's also, obviously, he's got great wisdom. He has studied. But that's not what makes him the greatest tenor in the world. I said, look at the love. Oh, so love me. I mean, he was just, every fiber of him was involved in this. He was just so, he was in love with what he was doing. And he wasn't selling us the song. He was selling us the love.
Yes.
That's the third pathway. But the highest pathway, what we really call mastery, is what we call surrender, which is when you get to that place where you realize that this is not you who's doing any of this, that you're not this body, this is not your home, this is not you that's doing it. There's something that you're connecting to called spirit or consciousness or higher awareness, and you're allowing God, I guess, if you will, to flow through you and send that out into the world. That's what the highest of them are. I mean, think of Michael Jordan says, I don't know how I do that. I just surrender.
Yes.
Yeah. That whole idea of being able to get your ego out of the way.
Yes. Let's talk more about that when we come back. I'm speaking with Wayne Dyer, author of Wisdom of the Ages and Manifest Your Destiny. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. My guest is Wayne Dyer, and we're talking about how we can follow our authentic path and actually do what we want to do and do it in ways that might surprise us. And Wayne, I wanted to follow up on the surrender, with the highest principle that you talked about, because one of the things in my experience, if I've learned a few secrets of life, not a lot, but a few. One of them is letting go.
Yes.
And it has to do with surrender. Letting go of wanting to control life. I mean, do you find that to be true?
I do. Well, I was just asked the question in South Africa, but they were interviewing me, one of the newspapers there, and the woman hit me with this question. She said, what's been the greatest accomplishment of your life? And my ego started really going into, you know, high gear. And I
yes.
was thinking about, you know, how many books I'd written, how many times I'd appeared on The Tonight Show, or,
yes.
you know, where I was on bestseller lists. I wasn't saying a word. I was just sort of rattling all of these things off that my ego wanted to say. And then finally it hit me. And I said to the woman, I said, I think the greatest accomplishment of my life has been my ability to tame my ego. And to no longer see myself as what I have and what I do and what other people think of me. I'm not my possessions, I'm not my accomplishments, I'm not my reputation. I've been able to see myself as a spiritual being, if you will, having that human experience. And that is involved with letting go. As they say in that recovery movement, you let go and you let God. And that may sound trite, but it's really one of the great secrets to being able to attract and manifest into your life. One of the people that I selected in Wisdom of the Ages was this man who we don't even know when he was born or when he lived. His name was Patanjali. I'm sure
yes.
you're familiar with Patanjali,
yes.
The original Yoga Sutras.
Yes.
And his book, How to Know God.
Yes.
And
wonderful translation by Swami Prabhupada and Christopher Isherwood.
Yes, yes, I have that.
Yeah, it's a great translation of that. Yes.
And it's just, I mean, every page. I've never read a book that I have, when I read it, I read a page or two and I set it down and I can't wait to get back to it, but I don't want to read it because I'm afraid it's going to end. Okay, that's how I feel about that book.
Right.
Because there's so much masterful kinds of experiences and aphorisms in there that we can apply and really, really reach these miraculous levels. Anyway, one of the passages that I used from Patanjali was about this concept called inspiration, which is really what we're talking about here, because the word inspiration, of course, comes from in spirit. And the word information comes from inform. So this is the age of information, and there's no shortage of information on this planet, you know, with a computer chip that can put the name and address of everybody in the United States on it, and it's the size of your thumbnail. We've got plenty of information.
Yes.
When someone is being considered for the Supreme Court nomination, and they provide a list of every movie he's rented for the past 10 years, that's more than we need to know about everybody.
It's a little scary.
Right, it really is, how much information we have about people. But what we have is a spiritual deficit, a deficit of spirit. So Patanjali talked about becoming inspired as a source of... and this is what he said. He said, when you are inspired by some great purpose, some extraordinary project, all of your thoughts break their bonds, your mind transcends limitations, your consciousness expands in every direction, and you find yourself in a new and a great and a wonderful world. And then he had this alarming thing to say. I laminated this and carried it with me. He said, dormant forces, faculties, and talents come alive, and you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. And all you have to do is become inspired, that is, move into the world of spirit. And once we do that, once we leave the form, once we leave the ego, once we leave the idea that I am what I have and what I do and my reputation, what others think of me, and begin to see ourselves as the beloved, as connected to rather than separate from God, and allow that higher spiritual awareness to flow into our lives, I think that's what we mean when we say surrender, when we say let go. I
yes.
know when I'm writing, if I let go, my writing is blissful and easy. When I struggle with it and I try to think about the right word and so on, I get stuck. Same in an interview, or the same in and when I'm speaking on stage, or whatever. When I let go, it's the old aphorism: when the student is ready,
yes.
you know, the teachers appear.
Tell us how you approach your speaking engagements. What do you do? Do you have a speech prepared? Do you take notes? Tell us how you do that.
I don't. I never use notes. If
right.
I speak for 5 hours, I don't use notes. I have some key words that I have in mind. I don't use paper or anything like that. I speak. What I do in an audience very often at the very beginning, Michael, is I'll say, if there's 1,000 people there, I'll say, I'd like everybody to just point to yourself. You know, everybody listening right now, it's a good thing to do. Just wherever you are, if you're even if you're driving, you can put one hand on them and just point to yourself. And you find that the 99.9% of the people, when they point to themselves, are pointing to their heart.
Yes.
Then you never see anybody point to their head.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So we are, you know, we don't think of who we are as our brain, and yet that's all we ever put our attention on is how much we know. And so I do that, and I meditate always for at least an hour before I speak. I get very, very quiet, and I repeat a mantra. And the mantra that I repeat usually in a hotel room someplace, just lying on the floor, is, how may I serve? 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 I just keep repeating that. So I try to get my ego out of it. It's like, this isn't about Wayne Dyer. This isn't about people buying my materials. This isn't about people giving me standing ovations. This isn't about being witty and clever and fun. It's like, these are people that you are there to serve. That's why you're here. You're here to serve. And I keep reminding myself of that. And if you do that for an hour, if you repeat anything, as, you know, Patanjali talks about that, the repetition of something continuously, it becomes your reality. And then when I walk out on the stage, just as I'm being introduced, I always repeat from A Course in Miracles the line that says, if you knew, not if you believed, but if you knew who walked beside you at all times on this path that you have chosen, you could never experience fear or doubt again. And I think to myself, I surrender. I'm not alone up here, and I'm operating from my heart, and I'm here to serve. And then I start speaking, and everything just flows. It's one of the easiest and most blissful and wonderful experiences.
Yes, I hear you. And, you know, there was a survey done not too long ago of the greatest fear that people have. And at the top of the list over all the fears was speaking in public.
Public speaking, that's right. Let me tell you, Michael, I make a living public speaking.
Yes.
When I was a young boy in the ninth grade at Denby High School on the east side of Detroit, with Mrs. Sarita Thompson as my English teacher, my English literature teacher, we had to give book reports, oral book reports. We had to do one every 2 weeks, all right? So we had to get up in front of that class, those 35 or so kids in there, and I had to get up and give a book report. Well, I would lie in my bed at night, and I would break out into a sweat, and I would be so frightened, and I would just wish that Mrs. Thompson would have a minor accident, okay? So that when it was my turn, maybe she wouldn't show up, a substitute would be there, and I wouldn't have to do it. I mean, It was a terrifying fear, literally, that would immobilize me. I wouldn't be able to sleep. I would think about it all. What if I make a mistake? And it's interesting because this has been the story of my life. When I have something that I'm really terrified of or really frightened of, and this is one of the few things that I ever really felt that kind of fear about, the next semester I signed up for public speaking.
Yes.
There's a course. And because I said, this thing owns me. And I don't think that I will ever be able to defeat it if I just hope that it goes away. And I took a course where I had to give a speech every third day for 20 weeks.
Yes.
And by the end of that 20 weeks, I had really overcome my fear of it. And then I began to love it. And now it's one of the times I feel most at bliss when I'm in front of an audience and speaking.
Yes. Yeah, I hear you. I have a similar story. When I was in the ninth grade, I went to a Jesuit prep school,
mm-hmm.
and I was sitting in the auditorium with the rest of the freshman class being welcomed by the headmaster. And it was kind of like an auditorium, and the seats were, you know, kind of together. And,
mm-hmm.
and he was up there saying, he said, and I remember this very vividly. He said, one of these days, you gentlemen in the audience there, you will be up here speaking to a full auditorium. And I remember, kind of getting as low as I could in my seat, you know, cringing with that statement, no, not me. I'm never going to do that. Forget it.
Right.
You know, how can I get out of here? You know?
Well, you know, it was interesting because after I got over that and I went into the Navy, I spent 4 years in the service, and I started giving courses when I was in the service. I'd give courses in philosophy and things that I just found interesting that I was writing about and reading about, and I would offer courses on board ship or when we were stationed on Guam. And then I got enrolled at the university, at Wayne State University in Detroit, after I got out of the service in 1962. And I used to sit there in class and watch these college professors who had a captive audience, who would have 200-300 of us in the class, and they were as dull and boring and uninterested and uninvolved and uninspired as it was possible to be. And I would sit there thinking, when it's my turn to be in front of an audience, I will never, ever treat my audience the way I am being treated right now.
Yes.
And I use that experience. It's interesting because some people, it's like children who grow up in families of, say, alcoholics. If you take 100 children that are raised in a family of alcoholism, half of them will look at that and say, that's the most horrible thing. I would never, ever want to do that. And they refuse absolutely to ever drink, and they stay away from it their whole life. The other half emulate it.
Yes.
You know, and the same with children who were born into families of a lot of wealth and so on. Some of them become philanthropists, and some of them become altruists and give a lot, and others just sit around and expect the world to take care of them.
Yes.
You can never predict the way that I would react to somebody treating me that way was to say, I would never allow myself to do that, rather than to emulate it.
Yes, well, I think that we all have experiences in our life. Everyone has experiences in their life that we've used as fuel.
Right.
That has fueled us. It may be very difficult experiences. It may be very, you know, we look back on it as, you know, it's a horrible experience, but we used it as fuel to catalyze a new direction for us.
Yes.
To push us, you know.
Well, you know, when I was learning to become a therapist, I had a professor who was very powerful influence in my life, and he said, you know, there are if you had a young kid who wasn't motivated, and you could say to, and you knew, if you could tell exactly how that person was going to react, and you could say to that person, you know, you're the dumbest, stupidest, you're the kid who's never going to be anything, you're never going to amount to anything in your life, and you did nothing but insult them, and that kid was wired together in such a way where he'd say, oh yeah, I'll show you, and for the rest of their life they went out there and they elevated themselves to the highest places that they could be in their chosen field. He said that was the most effective and important person that ever, you know, was in their life. If you knew how they would do it. He said, the problem is that most people don't know. And he said, that's what makes like a great coach, like a Vince Lombardi, for example. They say that he knew which person, when he was coaching them, that he had to get on and kick them in the rear end and force them to go out, and who he had to sit down and talk with and coddle, and who he had to be persuasive with, and who he had to use reason with, and who he could show pictures to, and so on. You know, it was like if you could figure out what it is that's going to help a person to drive themselves to a higher place, you would want to use that and not say that, you know, being critical is the worst thing that you can do. Because for some people, being critical, yeah, I have a poster in my room that says, I am thankful to all of the people who said I couldn't do it. Because of you, I was able to do just that.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's true. Thinking of Vince Lombardi, brings to mind that quote that he's often quoted as saying, winning isn't everything,
right.
Winning is the only thing. What do you
right.
think of that quote?
Well, I think it's absurd.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Because I think winning is, the idea of winning is that I evaluate who I am on the basis of how I stack up to those people I'm in competition with. Whereas I think the highest level of consciousness is one in which we are all connected. We all see ourselves as together rather than separate. I heard a wonderful story about that. I don't know if you've ever heard this story. How much time do we have?
Try me. Yeah, we have time.
Yeah. This is a story that Ram Dass told, I think it was in 1969, and I loved it. It's this whole story of what the difference between mystical consciousness, which is the consciousness of seeing yourself as connected to everyone, versus the consciousness of seeing ourselves as separate. And there was a shepherd, and he was in Nepal, and he was living at this highest level of consciousness. And a visitor from the West approached the shepherd and said to him, he said, would you mind if I ask you a few questions about your sheep? Have you heard this story?
Go ahead.
And the shepherd said, well, that would be fine. He said, how far do your sheep walk in a given day? And the shepherd said, which ones are you speaking about, the white ones or the black ones? And the man from the West said, well, he said, the white ones. And he said, well, the white ones walk 4 miles every day. He said, And he said, what about the black ones? He said, oh, the black ones too. And then he said to him, he said, well, boy, that's interesting. He said, well, could you tell me how much food, how much do they eat in a given day? And the shepherd said, well, which ones are you speaking about, the white ones or the black ones? And he said, well, the white ones. He said, well, the white ones eat 3 pounds of grass every single day. And he said, well, what about the black ones? And the shepherd said, well, the black ones also eat 3 pounds. And the man was a little bit stumped, and finally he said, well, he said, at shearing time in the spring, he said, how much wool do your sheep give? And the man said, how can I answer that unless you tell me the white ones or the black ones? And again he said, well, the white ones. He said, well, the white ones give 6 pounds of wool every spring. And he said, what about the black ones? He said, the black ones also. Finally, the man from the West said, look, he said, this is the strangest thing. He said, every time I ask you a question about your sheep, you divide it into the white ones and the black ones, and then you tell me the exact same thing. He said, I don't understand that. And the shepherd, who lived at this higher level of consciousness, said, he said, I can explain that. That probably is confusing. He said, you see all those white sheep out there? He said, I own those. Those are mine. Oh, the man said, I understand. He said, and what about the black ones? He said, those are mine too.
I'm speaking with Wayne Dyer, author of Wisdom of the Ages. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. My guest is Wayne Dyer, and author of Wisdom of the Ages, A Modern Master Brings Eternal Truths into Everyday Life, and another really wonderful book called Manifest Your Destiny, The 9 Spiritual Principles for Getting Everything You Want. I recommend both of them. Wayne, in Wisdom of the Ages, there was one of the sections or chapters dealt with mind power, and Sir Edward Dyer, relative?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Old Uncle Ed, I say.
Who was Sir Edward Dyer?
He was a great poet. He wrote probably the most famous poem that he ever wrote is the one that I quoted in here called "My Mind to Me a Kingdom Is." But he was here in the 16th century, and he was what they call an Elizabethan poet. And most of his poetry, there's only about 30 of his poems that ever survived. But this particular one about "My Mind to Me a Kingdom Is," and he goes through in that sort of the 16th century style, talking about the power of the mind to be able to create anything I want, and everybody else can think as much negative as they want to, but I'm going to use my mind power to create what I want for myself in my life, and I use that as a springboard for an essay on being able to create what you want for yourself in your mind, because yes. Basically that's where we do all of our living.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another interesting selection that you had, someone you chose, poets, was Joyce Kilmer. And I was struck by Joyce Kilmer because I grew up in Northern Virginia and happened to live close by to Joyce Kilmer's son.
And, is that right?
Yeah. And he had a...
I didn't even know he had a son.
Yeah, he did.
He died very young.
Yes, he did. And he had a community school, and I remember going there because some of Joyce Kilmer's son's children were part of my Cub Scout troop.
Is that right?
And anyway, they had it was interesting because it's interesting that you chose family and home and Joyce Kilmer, because his son was basically really trying to, it was clear at that time, very alternative. This was way before, it became... people were doing alternative schooling, mm-hmm. homeschooling, this kind of thing. And he was doing it. And this was like the late 40s, early 50s, mm-hmm. And anyway, I remember being struck by, I was really impressed by what this man was doing, what they were doing there. And I never forgot it. And of course, Joyce Kilmer and the Trees poem, everybody knows that. I think I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. And then he gets killed in World War One.
Well, I told you off the air before, but your program on deep ecology has a one selection in there by, what was his name, the man on trees?
John Seed.
That is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard about trees. I was so deeply, deeply, profoundly touched by that particular segment or that tape in there in your
Yes.
ecology series. But by the way, congratulations on that series.
It's Thank you very much.
Life-changing for me.
And Thank you.
I've had a lot of people listen to it, including my own children.
Well, it's been on over 600 radio stations around the
is
world.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just a great accomplishment.
Yeah, and it's timeless material. I still listen to it, and it's also still airing. And it doesn't get old,
Well, it's interesting because I listen to tapes every day, somebody's tapes, a lot of yours, of course. I'm always ordering New Dimensions tapes and plumping them in my Walkman when I run every morning.
Thank you.
But this particular, so I just got this series. I ordered it. It just looked good. And I thought, well, I'm interested in ecology. I'll listen to that. Well, when I started listening to that, it truly did turn my life around. It made me really conscious of how connected we are to everything on this planet and how deeply important every single aspect of life is. And I think that's what separates us out from lower levels of consciousness. I think that there's ego consciousness, there's group consciousness, and there's unity or God consciousness. And that unity consciousness, we don't just see ourselves as connected to each other. This whole idea that on a round planet there's no choosing up sides. We see ourselves as connected to everything that is here. We can't survive without any bit of it at all. The idea that we're separate from our environment. I always say, if you think that you're separate from your environment, just try spending 2 minutes without breathing, and see how
yes.
important that it is. And we talked about Rumi. You mentioned Rumi at the beginning of this
yes.
program. He had an observation. He said, I, you, me, he, she, they. These are distinctions which do not exist in the garden of the mystics.
Yes.
In the Garden of the Mystics. And when you think of yourself as a flower in the Garden of the Mystics, you see yourself as connected to every single thing. After I listened to that tape on by John Seed on trees, I have never looked at a tree the same again.
Yeah, right.
I never have. It's like I talk to trees now.
Right, exactly.
When he talked about how these pheromones of energy and how
yes.
they send signals to each other
and
how they communicate.
Build a community, right?
Yes,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And trees have a community, and they have, and what John Seed says, John Seed said that trees have lots of people helping them and serving them. And, you know, like the jay that picks up the acorn that buries the acorn and carries the acorn somewhere else, and the
right.
oak tree grows. I mean, it's like, it's amazing stuff.
It's a system.
You know?
It's a great set of tapes.
Yeah. A system that's totally
and I have mysterious. A feeling that Kilmer, who you yes. know, who went off to war in World War I and was killed as a soldier, I think he was 30 or 31 years old when he died.
He was very young.
Yes, he must have sensed that when he said, "I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree."
Yes,
And I think that level of consciousness is in all of them. One of the people that I selected here, one of the observations was from John Donne, another 16th century poet, who has this very famous line that everybody knows, no man is an island
yes.
unto himself. But he said, every man's death diminishes me. And I think he might have said, every plant's death diminishes me as well. Every animal's death diminishes me.
Yes.
He said, therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. These great poets, these great ideas are things that we still talk about and write about today, but they expressed it in ways that makes me aware of how spiritually advanced our ancestors were.
Yeah, it's true. It's like I think it's really, you know, Wisdom of the Ages, the book that you put together, and it just points up how important it is for us to stay connected to our ancestors and our own ancestral roots, because lots of people have walked the path before, and many of them have shared their wisdom, and it's there. We just have to access it.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever read the Rubaiyat.
Yes.
Omar Khayyam.
Yes.
He has an observation that, you know, when people say, well, I can't get over my past, you know, it's... when I was in Africa just recently, we went out on a safari for a few days, and there was a zebra that was grazing right outside our tent. There were six zebras, actually. And one of the zebras had a gash in its hind quarter from that must have been 9-10 inches long and deep, really deep. It was bleeding from there. And the zebra was out there grazing. And I said to the fellow who was taking us out there, what happened? He said, well, he was attacked by a lion yesterday, and he was able to kick the lion away. But the lion took a big hunk out of his rear, his hind quarter.
Yes.
And I said, and what is he doing now? He's out there grazing. And I said, the next person that comes to me and starts telling me about their childhood, and I'm going to remind them of the zebra. I said, this guy was being mauled by a lion yesterday,
yes.
and today he's out there grazing. Like, get over it.
Yes, know? Right.
And in the Rubaiyat, Omar Khayyam, 1,000 years ago, says, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all thy piety nor wit can lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out one word of it. I mean, it's just another way of saying, get over it. Live in the present
right.
moment.
And
the past is behind you.
And we've got to move on, Wayne. We're out of time. It's been great talking to you.
Always is, Michael. Thanks.
I've been speaking with Wayne Dyer, author of Wisdom of the Ages, and also Manifest Your Destiny, both published by HarperCollins. If you'd like to be in touch with Wayne Dyer, you can write to him. The address is 1905 North Atlantic Boulevard, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33305. That address again, 1905 North Atlantic Boulevard, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33305. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in San Francisco, California, USA, and is made possible by listener contributions and by the membership support of Friends of New Dimensions. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of the New Dimensions Radio staff and all those who are members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations, I'm wishing you lots of wisdom in your life. This is program number 2814.